From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Confirm Resolve, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are QA workflows and designing discovery. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a webinar.
I did another one, yeah. I'm tired. I'm not doing one in July. Already okay. Established. But yeah, I got to do a webinar with Ellen. Maybe we will be able to share it. We'll see.
Okay.
But I'm very glad to get a break from them for a month. Yeah. Part of that also means I have some headspace. I have more license to be able to play Dave the Diver after work because I don't have to make a webinar. And also plan my trip to Serious Games Conference, Teasel, in the last episode. I'm excited. I have a press pass. It's going to be in Rochester, New York, in August 13th to 15th. And apparently there is an esports thing on the 16th.
Yeah, you mentioned this to us, and we don't get it.
I don't. I need to read the webpage explaining what it is. Mm-hmm. And how maybe relates to Serious Games. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's its 18th year. It's apparently North America's largest dedicated games and learning conference. And Ellen has already done an interview with someone from that. So you can check out that episode.
Oh, is Ellen going to it?
We're figuring that out.
Oh, okay. That's exciting.
Yeah. It was my ability to go has now been figured out. So we'll see if Ellen can go.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll all find out together if you can snag an interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. True. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Dave the Diver. You've been playing that recently.
I have. It's okay. Fun.
Yeah. You put it in the notes. Do you have additional thoughts?
It's really good. I'm continually like very pleasantly surprised. I'm in chapter 6 now. Mm-hmm. And just throughout the game, they just keep like out of nowhere throwing something in, mm-hmm. that I'm like, okay, wait, what? We're in a dream sequence and it's a rhythm game. What are we doing now? Or then suddenly it's like, oh, it's a like Cooking Mama kind of. What? The animations are chef's kiss, buttery smooth, delightful. Music is great. I'm really enjoying it. I'm learning a lot of different sea creatures, mm-hmm. and turning them into sushi.
As one does.
As one does. It's really good. I that's the thing. I think I heard when it came back, when it got big, I heard that it was roguelike. I had not played it. I didn't really know anything about it. And then Ian picked it up on our PlayStation Pass, mm-hmm. tried it, was not their thing. And so I just was like, I'll try it. And it's my thing. It's great. Mm-hmm. The characters are charming and lovely. It's all good. Very good.
That's the kind of stuff I haven't heard about from Dave the Diver, is that the characters are charming. The main thing I've heard about Dave the Diver is it's got a lot of stuff.
Yeah. There's also a lot of crossovers, which I didn't expect. Yeah.
I guess it's been out for a little while now, so maybe that's like extra, but maybe it's not. I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crossover with Balatro.
Oh, then it's
a musician. And yeah, so much. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff, and it's really, really neat. I like it.
Cool.
I should probably play it just because you make good recommendations and you seem to really like it. So I probably
handle the slight roguelike elements that exist?
No, I'm going to resist it all the way. But you said it wasn't a lot.
No. And it's kind of fun. The conceit of it is there's this blue hole in the ocean, uh-huh. kind of surrounded in a harbor, and it's very, very, very deep. And for some reason, this particular blue hole has wildlife from all over the world. So like in the same blue hole, and it changes the landscape of it, or the topology of it changes slightly every day. It is pretty slight though. Okay. So like in the same blue hole, you get lionfish and like tiger sharks, and you get blobfish and halibut and different types of tuna. Mm-hmm. It's the like all sorts of species that shouldn't exist together, but they're all there, and you fish them and you make them into sushi.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I still need to finish the previous recommendation you gave me, which was Chants of Sinar.
Yes.
Which you've been asking me how every now and again. You're like, how's it coming? Because mm-hmm. you want to replay it.
Yes.
So that we can chat about it on the show.
Yes.
I've been so busy.
I know. That I'm not expecting you to stop being busy to finish it.
Yeah, but I do really want to finish that game because I think that would be fun to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good. Oh, man.
I'm really enjoying it.
Do I have to play it?
No.
Okay.
You can mediate.
It did seem actually particularly interesting.
I think if you can, if you're still firmly in your like logic puzzle brain from Blue Prince, I think you might, and you kind of look at it in terms of it is a logic puzzle of how much information you have versus what you don't and how much you can infer between the two, then I think you would like it a lot.
I have a love-hate relationship with cryptography.
You know what? I think so. I'll take a gamble on that and hope you love it.
Okay.
You know what I will say?
It's also short.
Okay, that's good.
If you kind of remove its theming,
yeah,
it's essentially a Metroidvania.
Yes.
Oh, sure. In terms of like knowledge you get.
Yeah.
I love that kind of stuff.
It's pretty good. It is. It's elegant in that way.
Okay.
Yeah. But, okay. But like just at its core, that is the mechanic ultimately.
Yeah.
Is a sort of gating you based on those things. But rather than piping up power-ups, it's...
You pick up knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I always love that kind of thing. There was this game I played years ago called Tokitori 2 Plus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just 2, but then they added more stuff. And it's basically a Metroidvania. It's just you could do all those things, you just don't know that you can do all the things until you get to certain locations. And I thought it was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it didn't sell very well because that company is defunct now. But
rip.
That isn't always why. Sometimes,
yeah, that's true. Sometimes it's
in games you can have a hit and go away
of whatever. But yeah, mm-hmm. I do love that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. Well, we'll check back. I mean, listeners now know that. I'm on the case, but we'll see. Well, let's start the show. I've got the first topic today, and it's sort of related to what I was just talking about, which is this is the first episode I think we're recording since Blippo Plus was announced.
Yeah. Yes.
Whereas we've talked about it on the show previously because it would be announced when the episode came out, but now where I'm sitting, it was announced.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And also just we don't have a release date announced. But other than fall, so yeah. It will not surprise you that I'm wrapping it up now.
Okay.
And so we're doing QA, and that is what I want to talk about because when I'm really busy, it's nice to bring a thing I'm already doing to the show.
Mm-hmm. So I don't have to think about it too much, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Beforehand. Yeah.
Convenience for me, but also benefit for you, the listener.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the first time that I've worked on a project that involved an outside QA company.
Okay.
Which is sort of interesting because the structure of the project is interesting. It's a smaller team than I've worked on compared to the past couple of games.
Yeah.
Because it's just me.
Yeah.
But it has many stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
That has been interesting and like weirdly imbalanced. We're making it work just fine.
Okay.
Like it's unusual.
Yeah.
But because of that, we have a localization team, we have a QA team, and these are groups that I didn't hire.
Right.
Right? Whereas like when we did Widget Satchel, like I hired, you know, or I worked directly with the localizers because mm-hmm. it was through the publisher that I got, right?
Yeah.
So it was a much closer relationship. Whereas this, I'm a little bit further away from all that part of it.
Right, right.
Even though I'm the only one working on the actual project.
Yeah.
So it's sort of strange. So I had to sort of it was a different experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
And also because I've never done QA myself.
Yeah.
And so I want to start the topic by talking about our QA experiences in our careers. Because I know, Stephen,
sure.
You did work in QA.
Yeah.
You probably, I mean, it wasn't for very long.
No.
But you probably know a lot more about those workflows.
Yeah. So I did QA. Really, I was an intern. So I didn't get paid very much. at Concrete Software. But I did get paid, actually.
You did get paid.
So that's a big deal.
Yeah. Actually.
Not a lot of places do that. So kudos to Concrete. But anyways, I worked there for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I effectively, I did a lot of the regression testing
yeah.
stuff. I think it was a lot. It was mostly regression testing. And then like there were specific bugs that I would test too. And really when you're doing like regression testing, you're just going through the entire thing to make sure any updates they added didn't break anything else they didn't intend to break.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're not looking for new bugs necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, you sort of are.
You're just making sure nothing new has broken that you didn't intend for because you added bowling mm-hmm. spin or whatever.
Right. You're not looking for the bowling spin bugs.
Yeah.
You're looking at everything else to see because you know, everything's all connected.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I did that for 6 months. And that was, I don't know, it's fine. That experience, it's tedious work, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of do the same thing every day, which can be kind of nice. But like a lot of the work is just like being detailed about how the bug is triggered. Your reproduction steps is very important because the developers need to understand how this triggers in order for them to be able to fix it.
Yeah, that has been the trouble I've had when I've had trouble working with QA.
Yeah.
Has been when I haven't had good reproduction steps.
Yeah, I've had the same issue.
Because then what you're left with is like this scary thing happens and all it can do is scare you.
Mm-hmm.
can't actually confirm it, or, you know, and that's not always their fault. Sometimes it's actually hard to find reproduction steps, or it doesn't appear very often.
Yeah.
But sometimes it can be just because they didn't make a lot of notes.
Yeah.
And that's been something that then you have to have a back and forth about. You have to ask questions and you have to be sort of be more involved.
And to be fair to the QA people, sometimes the bug that happens is just surprising and they don't expect it. And so it's difficult for them to remember the reproduction notes. Yeah.
And that's the challenge of the job, right? It's like to document your process even when you're not documenting a bug.
Mm-hmm.
Because one might show up and then you have to have your process documented.
Yeah, you have to keep it mentally in your head, or at the very least. In order to keep it down.
Because sometimes when you find something, you can then try to reproduce it.
Yeah.
But sometimes that it's not a guaranteed reproduction, and so you do need to know how it happened.
Right.
Yeah.
But I've also been on the other side of working as a dev with QA, because when I worked at Pixel Eggs, we had two QA folks on staff. And that was they were pretty good about like reproduction steps and things like that.
Yeah.
When they were doing it, which was very helpful. And I worked very closely with them. Because like they would actually, what would happen oftentimes is, like, I'd be working on something, and then they were testing the latest build, and they'd be like, hey, Steven. They're like, oh, no, it's another bug. It would be the worst. It's good, because, like, I need to know about these bugs so I can fix them.
Yeah.
But what was nice about it is, like, they would ask me questions about if this functionality is correct. And really, that means I didn't do a good job documenting how this functionality is supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't always the designer, so sometimes it's not my fault.
Put
that on a t-shirt. Sometimes it's not my fault.
Yeah.
I need that as a cross stitch just in my office to look at sometimes.
Yeah, for real. I get that. I feel that. I think it was really valuable to be able to work with somebody, work with QA directly and be able to communicate with them very quickly, because we were all in the same office.
Yeah.
And I had it, I think my cubicle was right next to theirs. So like I would just like go over there and they could just show me what the issue was, in addition to having the steps. And so like it was just nice to have that kind of back and forth. So then we can quickly iron out whatever happened. But like I was kinda at the mercy of QA's skill too, because like sometimes there would be bugs that would slip through their expertise, what they were looking for.
Yeah.
And it might cause a significant issue. When we released Treasure Stack, there was a big issue with the ranked mode. The people were unlocking the skins where they weren't supposed to, and that eluded QA's notice.
Yeah.
So like just sometimes there's just big things that slip through the cracks, because it's hard to predict.
Yeah.
When you release it to audiences, they're going to be the biggest QA, and they're not going to detail specifically how anything triggers. And why things are triggering, because they don't know all that information and it's not their job. So you oftentimes get those things that you were talking about, Mark, where like you just get like this thing is happening, please fix it, and you're like, I what am I supposed to do about it?
Yeah.
But then you get like hundreds of those kinds of reports from audience members, and that's scarier.
Yes. Yeah. I think I want to follow up on a lot of that as we go through. But I want to hear from Lydia, your experiences with QA, because your industry is slightly different, but I imagine some processes are similar?
Yeah, I think so. So my first experience with QA was as a design intern with Phoenix Online Studios. So I did some very light QA for Gabriel Knight, Sins of the Father, the remake that they did. Basically, just it was a thing I could do. And that was where I first started. I learned about kind of the informal process of the QA. Also, there was actually a QA intern interning at the same time. I also got credited in the credits, which was really nice. Accidentally encountered them in a YouTube comments of a playthrough of that, which was really sweet. Anyway, so that was where I first was exposed to that, and specifically where I learned like the severity of bugs, the difference between like a hard lock bug or a critical bug, and
I found that out when I did QA intern.
Which then meant that like I was able to start noticing the types of bugs. I even hit a soft lock bug in the Lego game one time, which was fun. But then once I started working at Filament as a designer, I think it's a little bit different than a lot of places. I was very much in Jira. I wrote all the user stories in Jira. I wrote it. I organized it into epics. I helped producers do all of that kind of stuff and with road mapping. And then once something was moved from in progress in Jira to confirm resolve, it was my job as the designer to go into the game, into a build of the game, or eventually, or in engine if I was able to be in engine for that project, confirm that it was indeed actually working, move it to done, which is where it would get auto reassigned to QA. Mm. So that way during QA sprints, they would go through those.
Yeah.
So essentially I was the last bastion between the team and QA.
Ah.
During that process of confirm resolve, I would also make a spreadsheet of other bugs and improvements and things that I noticed. So that way, before we cut a build for QA to look at, we could go through and say like, okay, are we going, these are things that we think are going to come up or that we've noticed.
Yeah.
Do we want to fix them now? Do we want to fix them later? What do we think is happening with them? Or are these improvements that we want to just keep track of but not put on the board because we're probably not going to do them?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. And then, you know, our QA team at Filament was absolutely fantastic. That's where I kind of my sense of severity of bugs
yeah.
got more sophisticated because they did it on a kind of a, not Punnett square, but that sort of chart where on one axis it is how many people are affected, and on the other axis it's how severe is it.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if it's super severe but only affects certain people, that is going to be graded on a letter scale differently than if it is somewhat severe, but everybody is experiencing.
Yeah.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah,
then
yeah.
that allows us to prioritize which bug, like when we go through QA, which ones we need to fix first or which ones we absolutely need to fix and which ones we just like can punt.
Yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting insight because I think the two dimensions that I tend to use for either internally tracking issues or working with QA is urgency and priority.
Mm.
So like this is a thing that it's urgent or it's the high priority. It has to get fixed before we ship.
Yeah.
But we can do it later.
Yeah.
Right? So it's low urgency. And then you have the other way around, which is this is actually a small bug, but it's actually causing a lot of problems in testing. So it's high urgency.
Yeah.
And so adding that extra dimension to better clarify urgency or priority, which is mm-hmm. how many people versus its severity, is not a way I've looked at it before, but yeah. that makes a lot of sense.
I think with priority and urgency was not ever explicitly done, but I think that was the implicit understanding of
right.
once we get the letter grade back and we have a sense of how bad the bug is in the list and we're going in order from like worst, like A bugs to D bugs or E bugs or whatever.
Yeah.
That is then where we are in, as a conversation as devs and as the team, that's kind of the understood internal metric of, oh, we should deal with this right now. This is a problem and we can't deal with these other things. Or we have time. We can deal with this because I already have the files open. Let's grab yeah. this cosmetic bug. And then, of course, as the designer, I have to make sure, you know, in the user stories, I had to do the acceptance criteria properly. I have to make sure that documentation is available and linked and up to date and be in contact with QA. So that way, if it is expected behavior, they could just check in with us. What is expected?
Yeah.
So I end up having to think a fair bit about that sort of stuff, or especially in previous jobs. Not right now. We use our Jira board a little bit differently, but I'm still like, if I see a bug, I write a ticket.
Yeah.
I am available to find documentation if it didn't get linked or if to clarify a question that the devs have because a ticket got kicked back to them by QA. Stuff.
Yeah, yeah. When I was at Future Club, we had when we were working on the that vertical slice mm-hmm. Thing. I was working really quickly, and so I was adding a lot of bugs into the yeah. vertical slice.
Yeah.
And so I had a lot of people on the team who weren't devs. Just focus on QA stuff, but they're not QA, so like they would report that this is an issue and they would sometimes record footage or take a picture, and that's helpful.
Oh yeah,
100%. But they oftentimes wouldn't put in like reproduction steps, and so I'd have to ask for that, and that slows you down.
Yeah,
you're trying to figure out how to fix those kinds
that's
of bugs.
One of the things I was very fortunate about at Filament was
yeah
we had really good QA people in-house
mm-hmm.
which with a very clear process, a very thorough process.
Yeah.
And so like I learned what is important in a QA ticket. And I also learned, like, there was never a question. I never had the chance as a game dev in my career mm-hmm. to think that QA was not game dev.
Yeah.
Or to develop a stereotype against that.
Yeah, that's good.
Which was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of what you're speaking to both of you are about, like, there's having a workflow in place.
Yeah.
And yeah.
criteria for urgency, for priority, for all that stuff.
Right.
And for, like, who does it, how replication steps are documented.
Mm-hmm.
That is a way to basically like save you time
yeah.
dealing with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, yeah, just that this isn't working or here's a paragraph about the problem. like, you can, a lot of times that's actionable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's very quickly actionable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times it's totally obtuse and you just spend like a half an hour figuring it out.
Yeah.
And so that isn't always necessarily, I would venture, a property of how good you are at putting it, documenting.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's about agreements between the teams about what does this mean, right? So like we're just talking about like sort of the you know, priority system. Like if you just have a letter grade, then like that's just very simple. Mm-hmm. But like for so my internal process is splitting it into urgency and priority is helpful because sometimes I'm working on things that where urgency matters more. Sometimes working on things where priority matters more. So I need to separate those things sometimes. But that needs to be a shared understanding between a QA team and the development team.
Right.
Going back and forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Or there needs to be some translation layer that you have to you know, make that sort of happen.
Well, it also changes the conversation when you, if you ever have to kick something back to QA and say, I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to do this right now, it changes the way that you have the conversation later. So for example, like if there is if there's a bug that's pretty significant or annoying, or it just looks sloppy, but we have on the roadmap to redo that feature in a month, that might be a very, like, that means, it's affecting everyone and it's really obvious, but it's not high priority right now.
Yeah.
And so being, if that's your metric, being able to have that conversation, it changes the kind of the response to that initial accost, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk tools a little bit.
Sure.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because there's kind of just one type of tool. There's just many different options.
Yeah.
But really, you're making tickets, you're tracking tickets.
Yep, yep.
It's kind of pretty much how it works in all cases. Mm-hmm. If you want to use Post-it notes and you're all in-house, go nuts.
I love spreadsheets.
Spreadsheets work too.
With drop-down conditionals for like status and stuff.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a tool like Trello or Jira is essentially that. You know, on steroids, but it's the same kind of idea, right? Mm-hmm. So you do want to choose a tool that scales to your team and to your project because it actually is it's a tool. You have to learn how to use the tool.
Yeah, for sure.
And so if that is something that you don't have time for, then maybe like just keep it in a spreadsheet or even just like a Google Doc. Like I'm actually not recommending that, but I'm saying like you don't have to feel bad if that's the system you have.
Yeah.
As long as everyone's on the same page and it's working. And even if it's a little slower than it would be if you used a full-on ticket tracking system, maybe you're saving a lot of time teaching everyone how to use that.
It's dramatically better to have something than absolutely nothing.
Absolutely.
Because, then.
Yeah. Also because archive is really important with QA.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And that's a big value to these ticketing systems. So I'm going to talk about four of them and just my, you know, opinions. I don't want to hear you guys on this.
Sure.
We shouldn't spend too much time on this. One is Jira. I hate Jira. Wipe Jira from the face of the planet.
Uh-huh.
But it's very popular.
Yeah. I mean, Jira's fine.
Yeah. You probably have a lot more experience actually using it rather than sort of using it and then giving it up as possible.
Yeah, I've used a lot of Jira in my time. I actually recently relearned how to add tickets in bulk using a CSV file.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I've used Jira a lot.
And that's the thing. Jira is, it's the thing that has all the features.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a million ways to do it.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly custom, especially a content management system.
Yeah.
It's really, really flexible, but also like so fiddly.
Yeah.
If you're on a team, I used Jira when I was working in commercial advertising, and it was definitely a bigger tool than we needed.
Yeah.
And it was more complicated than what we needed for a lot of things like that. But what helped in that case is we had someone to manage it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a person whose job it was to manage Jira.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Where I would say like, oh, I did this, and then they would move the tickets.
Yeah,
like I didn't have to.
That's the idea.
I still had to learn it, which it was still a dumb up, you know, system.
Uh-huh.
But for a system that heavy, it's nice to have. Now that isn't always the case, right?
Yeah.
So that's Jira. Any other thoughts, Lydia?
I will also say it is definitely bigger than a lot of teams need.
Yeah.
The one thing that's really nice about Jira, I think for the devs, there's a lot of things that are nice for project managers, account holders, whatever. But for devs, there is linking of issues. Mm-hmm. It also will show you the history of the ticket. So if it got closed and then it got reopened, or if it went back and forth for a while,
that's
what
useful.
Things are spread from it, especially when it comes to like, you can say bugs are related to each other or one came from another or mm-hmm. or like a bunch of bugs came from this one feature.
Yeah.
Being able to record some of that and be able to look back when you need it is extremely helpful.
Yeah.
And also it allows you to add videos to the tickets, to images to the tickets, comment on them versus description. sort them into buckets. There's a lot of things that if your project is big or it can get hairy, being able to untie the spaghetti before it, like, because there's a lot of problems, a lot of spaghetti on the table, that's very helpful.
Yeah. So another tool that is has a lot of those features. Mm-hmm. That this is what we're using on Blowhole Plus with the QA team that was hired. This is their workflow is ClickUp. Which is basically a cross between Jira and Trello, which is more familiar to people. We'll talk about more of that in a minute.
Yeah,
it is has a lot of that. Like history is a big part of it. It is very flexible. You can create variables for tags and stuff. It's complicated. I would say the UX I would describe as very bad. it's like a web app. It's kind of friendly and bubbly, but like that's not actually what it is. It just looks like it is.
Okay,
it's closer to Jira than that.
Okay,
and so it kind of lulls you into this sense of like, oh, this is a light touch with some good UX. It's like, oh no, I need to study how this works.
Yeah.
So I've had some difficulties with it, but it's their tool, so I needed to learn it.
Yeah.
And so that's been a little bit frustrating for me. It also has a very robust permission system, which Jira also has.
Yeah.
And that has been difficult because of the timeline in this project.
Right.
There have been things I needed to do that I just didn't have the permissions to do.
Oh.
Not for any particular reason, just because we just didn't, our timeline is so tight that like things slip through the cracks.
Sure.
Big important question. Is it obvious to you when you don't have permission to do something? Because if you don't have a permission to do something in Jira, you can't see the thing. So you don't know that you don't have permission.
Yeah, ClickUp's a little better than that, but not so much better because it exposes everything to you, mm-hmm. and then when you can't do it, it's very much a trombone noise. Like I'm like, oh, okay, I'll do this, and I do this, and oh, I can't do the last thing.
Yeah.
So I have to not do it, and like this doesn't make no sense now because I can't do that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of the opposite problem, which is a little bit frustrating. But like that's kind of maybe that's telling that like there's no one correct way, right? There's
I think personally that's easier to QA because then you can say, hey, I can't do this, what gives?
There's more visibility into what the problem is in terms of that for sure.
That's
but
right.
Because the team, I mean, the QA team is relatively small, about four or five people,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm the only person on the development team. So it's just we've had meetings about this since.
Yeah.
But it started out we're just like, I can't actually do everything on here. Like, you don't need to have a really complicated permission structure for a team this small.
Right.
So ClickUp was a little bit difficult for me, but it works for them because they use it on different projects of different size. It needs to be sort of generic to them.
That makes sense.
And so it was incumbent on me to learn how to use it and complain as little as possible about it.
Yeah.
But I don't like it.
Yeah.
The two other systems are ones I'm more familiar with, and so that biases me. But I like them both.
Okay.
One is GitHub Issues.
Mm-hmm.
So GitHub Issues, I would describe as a little bit nerdy, and that the UX is not great.
Yeah.
But if you use GitHub for your project, you are, as for indie developers, you actually have a huge leg up in terms of learning the quirks of GitHub Issues. And so I think that lets it get away with a little bit of like not optimized UX. But like considering the space it's in, like the bar is pretty low.
Yeah.
But because if you are someone who uses GitHub for your repo, there's two advantages to GitHub Issues. One is that it's directly tied to your code base.
Right.
So you can do cross-reference commits,
mm-hmm.
and all that cross-referencing you were talking about, Lydia, with Jira, that's all built into this as well. And mm-hmm. it's actually really it's so simple it's dumb in a way that's like good.
Okay.
Which is that when you're managing what is essentially a database, right?
Yeah.
It can be very complicated for things like tokenization of what's this thing? GitHub has a very dumb idea, which is just everything is numbered and the numbers go up.
Yeah.
So like an issue, a commit, everything is a number. There's no distinction between them.
Oh.
And so if you want to, when you're using your local Git client,
mm-hmm.
and you want to say like, oh, this thing fixed that bug. You just go and you say, well, that's number 62, all right? So I just type in fix number 62 into my commit message. And when I put that on GitHub, GitHub sees $62.
Uh-huh.
And then it looks, is there anything that called 62 in this project?
Yeah.
Oh, that issue. Okay, then we're going to close it because in the commit message it says fixed. So there's some automation built in.
Okay.
If you know how it works.
That's a ticket tracking thing for devs.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it can be used if QA is on board. It depends on your sort of if you're paying for GitHub,
yeah,
you know, there's where you can give people visibility into the issues system, but not the repository.
Sure, yeah.
If you're using the free version of GitHub, you have all that for your internal team, mm-hmm. and if you can trust your QA folks, if you have internal QA, no problem.
Yeah.
But if you're going to trust to have visibility into your repo, which isn't always a good idea.
Yeah.
Then you have that. But otherwise, I think if you have a professional or enterprise account, you can basically give people permissions on the issues, but not the repo.
Sure.
And so I think the thing that I like about it a lot is that it can serve multiple audiences within a project.
Okay.
As long as it's all within GitHub.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which isn't always possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what I do like it for internal tracking with just outside of QA, just with your own team.
Mm-hmm.
So because a lot of, especially for indie teams, if you're not hiring QA, you still need to do QA.
Yeah.
Right? And that means you need to have something that's already built into the systems you're using. And so GitHub Issues is a really good candidate,
yeah,
for that,
yeah.
I think.
That does make sense.
Yeah, it's a little bit wonky, but like you're already in that workflow or in that tool chain, most likely. I mean, if you're using Bitbucket or something, Atlassian, they make Jira and they have some issue system part of Bitbucket. So like, I'm not as familiar, but if you can find for or GitLab or any of the other repo systems, mm-hmm. a lot of them do have their own ticketing systems.
Yeah.
GitHub Issues is the one I'm familiar with.
Okay.
But that's a good option if you're already in that system and you have a small team where everyone can have access,
mm-hmm.
Either because you're paying for that account or because you're a small enough team and everyone has access.
Mm-hmm.
I really like GitHub Issues. I found that very productive. It also, if you give everyone the sort of like the very slight training about like when you create a ticket, you can reference a commit, like this appeared in this commit, because when you're working internally, you don't have build numbers yet.
Yeah.
So you can't always label stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to be able to say like, I found this as of this commit.
Yeah.
And you can cross-reference all of that. You can say, yeah, fix this issue, reference this other ticket. And because it's a very dumb system, you just type it right in the thing. You don't have to do, you know, it has a little drop downs and auto completes and stuff as well, which is very handy. But you don't have to necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And then recently, and I say within the past couple of years is recent, but it's recent-ish compared to the lifetime of GitHub Issues,
mm-hmm.
You can do Kanban boards that's very much like Trello.
Okay.
And those can be, and you can do that without even creating issues. You can just have a Kanban board,
yeah.
Which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute, where you can just have items, and then you can turn them into issues if you want to, or they can just be notes. Mm-hmm. So there's some flexibility there. It's a little bit wonky, but I think unlike the other ones we've talked about, I think it's more forgivable because of how interconnected it is to the systems you're likely already
using. Yeah, like you said, I think that the main benefit of GitHub Issues, which I haven't used before, and I'm just hearing it from you now,
mm-hmm.
Is that like you have it all in one ecosystem, so it's useful specifically if you're like a solo dev or you only have like a team of two or three.
Yeah.
And you're all using Git anyways, so like this is a great way to start tracking stuff out of there.
Well, it also sounds nice because it takes the step in between of like how tracing back the issue and who might be able to fix it. In Jira, it'd be like, okay, who was tasked this thing? Who closed it?
Yeah.
And then you have to go to figure out what that commit was.
Yeah.
Whereas there, you know exactly both at the same time.
Yeah, it saves a little time if you hook it up together. All right. You know?
Yeah.
The other thing, and this is actually the more common use case for GitHub Issues,
mm-hmm.
is open source projects.
Yeah, that's right? The thing that seems like it's extremely useful.
Yep. And so I maintain Noble Engine, which is my little game engine for Playdate.
Yeah.
And GitHub Issues is for that. It's mm-hmm. used in that public way. People submit issues publicly. And it works very similarly, but of course the relationships are slightly different. The types of issues, there isn't a lot of, you know, I have guidelines on reproduction steps, but mm-hmm. like people are just encouraged to submit whatever.
Yeah.
And then if I don't have a lot of information, I close it or move it or ask for more. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
But all those benefits, which are really meant to serve like a wide, I would say even like uneducated audience, like, and I'd say in terms of your workflows, like it's meant to be accessible is probably maybe a better word. That can benefit you if you're using it as an internal tool as well.
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer in it. I think it could use a lot of improvements, but I think like given the, you know, the marketplace of this sort of thing, for indie developers, you know, from, you know, 1 to 10 size teams, I think it's very, very good.
Mm.
Okay, last one I want to talk about is Trello. And a lot of people are familiar with Trello. Some people aren't. But Trello is basically a Kanban board. Mm-hmm. So a Kanban board is columns. And then in the columns, you have little essentially post-its, which represent the issues. And then you move them from column to column as through the life cycle of the ticket.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All of these systems can do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or they have ways to view your issues in this way.
Yeah.
But I, um, in the case of GitHub Issues and Jira, it was something that was added later after they were already successful products.
Yeah.
Whereas with ClickUp and Trello, that was the foundation of them. Well, ClickUp has a bunch of different ways to do it, but it's a newer tool. Mm-hmm. But the Kanban board is very popular for a really good reason. It's a good way to visualize your issues.
Yes.
You can see how long the list is. You can sort things into, you know, working on, worked on, in the current build, in the upcoming build, done, close, reopen, need clarification. And those columns, you can decide for yourself what they are, so you can build them to your own thing. And the thing about Trello is just very, it has tagging and labels, and you can assign users, mm-hmm. very much like these other systems. But it's kind of designed to be used more casually.
Yeah. A lot of those functionalities, those features aren't really foregrounded. You have to look for them a little bit in a way that, like, keeps them hidden if you don't need them. And oftentimes when you're using Trello in that way, you don't necessarily need those features.
Yeah. We talked with Freya last week about the sort of what are defaults and how that implies how users should use your software.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Trello is very much like a, just get your tickets in there.
Yeah.
And then, like, if you want to be more detailed, you can be.
Yeah.
But it's, whereas the other systems, they don't fall apart, but they're much less useful without that extra metadata imposed upon them.
Yeah.
And so Trello is really good for small teams who just do not have a lot of time for this.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just gets the thing done. It's like, here's a list of to-dos, here's what we're working on, here's what's finished. And that is very handy.
Yeah.
They all can kind of work like that.
Yeah.
But Trello is probably the easiest to get started, especially if you just have no appetite for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, any system is better than no system. And if you have no appetite for any system, I think Trello is a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And the free version is fairly full-featured in this regard.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think you have to buy I mean, there are more features, but if you're just looking for something light, I don't think I would say maybe the paid Trello version is probably, at that point, you might want to look into something else. But people like it. The free version is great.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend looking at that, especially, and that's good for personal projects as well. When it's just you and, like, it's your own notes, then Trello is maybe the best option.
Yeah.
Because it helps you keep track of stuff, and it just presents no burden upon you, which would be required if you're working with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're just working by yourself, all that extra metadata is not that useful.
Yeah.
So I like it quite a bit. Okay. So I want to talk about the life cycle of a ticket. So all these systems work this way. This is sort of the process of, like, how it's logged, which we talked a little bit about, like, you know, replication steps.
Yep.
Whether you're doing regression testing, what type of thing you're doing.
Yep.
But then how you actually move it across the either Kanban board or through the status types until it's closed ticket.
Yeah. And this is the way that you do this is super important, because, like, it changes how, like, people approach fixing bugs and getting bugs tested.
And it's very important you have an agreement on how that works.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? When do you put it in the closed column? Who is allowed to, independent of the permissions on the project, like if the software has a permission system,
mm-hmm.
like, who is expected to close it versus who is expected to say, please close this?
Yeah.
You know?
And so that communication is really, really important. That's something that on Blippo Plus was something where we had to have a meeting very recently just to align that all, because everything was stacked on. This is nobody's fault.
Mm.
It's just the timeline near the end has been so tight that we just haven't had a chance. We've been just going kind of on, like, didn't always know where to put a ticket when I was done with it or when I was working on it, because I didn't want to presume something, because they would need to do regression tests.
Right.
And so if I closed the ticket, then, like, even though I was certain it was done, like, would they just feel like it disappeared?
They might not test it.
Yeah. Or would they confirm? And so, and I had to, because I had fewer permissions on the project than I should have at the beginning.
Okay.
We had to talk about, like, making sure that the workflow worked for both sides, because we just didn't do that step at the start.
Yeah.
And so we got through it, and partly because the team size is so small, because the possibility for catastrophic errors was pretty low.
Yeah.
This last couple of weeks has been a lot better, because we've sorted all of that out.
Nice.
And that's kind of what made me think about doing this topic, is just how important it is to do that.
Yeah.
Even when you can start doing it and it seems fine, it does eventually start catching up to you.
Yes.
You know? Especially when you're crunched for time is the way I
am. Yeah, for sure.
But I want to ask you guys about, like, that kind of notion. Like, is it good to have it as simple as possible or more complicated than you need to account for things that come up that you don't expect?
I think it needs to be a little more complicated than you would expect, I guess.
Okay.
My thinking is, so when I was at Future Club, I oftentimes would put my tickets not in done, but I would put them in, like, ready to review or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm the only programmer, and so I'm the only one who, like, knows if the code is implemented.
Right. Who else is going to review it?
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't want to be the one reviewing it, because that's, you know, I'm biased. I'm like, yeah, of course I did it perfectly. I did it. so what I would do, I would always put it there, and then during a meeting, we would have people look at what I did to see if it worked the way that people intended it to. Mm-hmm. I guess it's not necessarily specific to bugs. It's always just like feature implementation, but like also bugs. I wanted people to like confirm. Somebody else needs to do the confirmation that the bug is fixed.
Yeah, I mean, we have that. I think in general with features, but also that's been something that I've also been talking with my team about, because I have tickets, they should go into needs review.
Yes.
Whose job is it to actually review my tickets?
Yeah.
And because having someone else give the final say that yes, this is fulfilled, especially just a second eye on the ticket, because you might miss something like, oh, I forgot to do this one step that we needed.
Yeah.
Or, oh, wait, but you didn't apply it to this thing. You just sometimes can't see that.
Yeah.
It's the same reason why it may feel, I think the idea of more complicated than you think, but not so complicated that you don't need it.
Yeah.
Is, I imagine, very similar to having protocols of having merge requests and code reviews. Like, yeah, you probably don't need it necessarily if you trust your team, but it's a really good protocol to have in place because it means you don't end up making bigger problems that fester.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I think we're all on the same page about this.
Cool.
I think that there's an instinct to be like, to pre-optimize how these systems work so it doesn't feel weighty, but then you're always going to have the edge case that needs it to be a little bit more complicated, whereas normally it's perfectly fine to have a couple empty columns most of the time because they're there to be used rarely when needed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm in full agreement with both of you on this.
Yeah, it's nice to have like a blocked column, and most of the time you don't use a blocked column, but periodically you do, and it's helpful to know that this thing is a blocker because of such and such.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like those kinds of things.
Yeah, what was important for me is on Blippo Plus was because I was working so fast that I was submitting about a build every 6 to 8 days, so about once a week, but I was closing things so quickly that there would be that almost that entire stretch where things were done, but I couldn't put them in the claimed fixed in build because the QA didn't have it yet.
Yeah.
So I definitely needed a fixed in upcoming build.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't always need that.
Yeah.
Right? And especially near the end of that, where I could just like move them all as I was putting the build up or whatever.
Yeah.
So little things like that.
That's a good use of columns. I like that.
Yeah. I think the thing that we are agreeing on is the first level of complexity one should have, and then you can kind of add in or subtract as needed once you do this, is having a designated space where someone checks your work, and having someone designated to check certain types of work. Because I think also, ideally as a team, you end up working together. Like, I want as a designer that I can talk to everybody and they can also contribute and vet and figure out the design with me.
Yeah.
But ultimately, even though we want an egalitarian team, I want someone to tell me if the thing is done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to look at it anymore. Mm-hmm. And therefore we need to have and also people might just not want to take that on because they don't want to seem presumptuous, like they're the one taking charge and telling another person what's what.
Yeah.
Having that agreement, whether it's everyone just kind of is like, I don't want to do it, but like, I guess someone should. Or if it's like we need to actually have someone to check ourselves, that needs to be agreed upon, and it needs to be a person.
Yeah. And what's handy about QA processes is that you as a developer are unlikely to have a lot of strong opinions about it. you may have some.
Yeah.
But it's important that there is a decision maker and a decision.
Yes.
Right? So just thinking about like those columns, like sometimes you could say like, well, let's sort these things, like my example of like fixed in. Like, well, what if we just label I'll just label which build number I fixed it in as a thing.
Yeah.
Could do it that way too. Mm-hmm. But then that's difficult for me because I am working on many things at once. So having that overview visually without having to drill down into the labels would be really handy. On the other hand, certain types of bugs, like one of the things I wanted is because Blippo Plus is so has so much text in it that when there would be typos, that would show up as in the bug list along with everything else as low priority. But that would distract me because like that can all be fixed, like all 20 of them can be fixed at once, and actually not by me. So
yeah.
So like that was kind of distracting for me. But It turns out that the solution to that was to make a label for that rather than a different column, because making a different column would cause problems for the QA team that I didn't anticipate.
Right.
When we talked it out, it was like they explained that to me, like, oh, okay, I will put up with it on my end then, because it's more beneficial for you to have this.
Yeah.
And because I didn't have a strong enough opinion, and because you have to also make sure that you're empathetic to the needs of the rest of the team. Well,
they also implemented a blinder for you. You didn't have to panic when you saw a new ticket, because you could see that it was a typo and automatically then just turn off the alarm.
Right. And ClickUp has like filtering tools. I don't like them. They're not very useful.
Okay.
But like, they're there. And I've already agreed to like use the system. Sure. So like, I can't really complain past that. So that's a good solution, right?
Yeah.
So just make sure that there is, you know, a system.
Yeah.
And if it's not the system you like, that's still better than two people using it in a slightly different way or whatever. So the last thing I want to talk about in this topic is actually just an interesting thing that you don't think about a lot when you're thinking about QA, and not many people in the indie space have direct experience with, which is CQA, which can be called other things, but it's for certification. This is for console development.
Yeah.
So this is also true for, if you're making PC games, it's just that the actual list of things is way lower or less defined. But the idea is that you're not testing for bugs, you're testing for things that will prevent the game from coming out.
Yes.
And that just sounds like a matter of severity. But in a lot of cases, what you think is a bug is up to you.
Yeah.
Whereas what Nintendo thinks is a blocker is up to them.
Uh-huh.
And so because we have all the guidelines for these things, we can kind of preempt it. We can do it ourselves before we send it to them to do it. And then that will increase our chances of sailing through LawCheck.
Yeah.
So that's a whole separate process that the QA team... and I've been educated on this a lot recently. Like, they need to be in the mindset of doing that.
Yeah.
And not worry about other stuff.
Yeah.
And so we've had difficulty on that because they're on the timeline. Everything's stacked on top of itself. They've been doing a pretty good job of rolling with it. But also, I tell you, when you're talking about earlier, I didn't want to make this topic about this because it feels like a settled question. But the idea is, are QA game developers? And like, when the QA describes to you like the different testing they do for the, to certify a specific rule.
Yeah.
Like, you look at that and you think there is nothing else to describe that except for game development.
Exactly.
Like, there's just no, because it can be a specific expertise.
Yeah.
But because I have done this kind of work for Switch games in the past, hearing the QA team talk about it at the level that they perform it at, knowing I wasn't ignorant to it, but also it let me know that, oh yes, when I did that, that felt like game development.
Yeah.
So of course when they do it, it's game development.
Yeah.
Well, but it makes you really appreciate, and like, you know, they sometimes just need to sit with the thing running for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I build like debug tools to like speed things along, but you can't really
test. Can't always do that.
You can't test for that because it's not the actual proper thing. And one of the things that I learned through this process was I tried to do a lot of efforts to like make their job easier.
Yeah.
And they were like, please don't bother.
Yeah.
And that was sort of interesting to me because I was sort of assuming what their burdens were.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that was like me not giving them enough credit, frankly. And also it's now made it easier to me because I don't have to worry about it as much.
Yeah.
But like, they have a job to do. They are really good at it. Mm-hmm. And it is a pivotal part of the game development process. So that is what's happening right now, is we're doing that. It doesn't necessarily mean it's coming out immediately or anything.
No.
Yeah.
But it does mean that's the part, because we want to be kind of ahead of the things.
Yeah.
We definitely want to have all those things tested. And we have the guidelines, and I'm lucky to be familiar enough with them personally from previous projects this has been a good process. Whereas previous rounds of QA, because it's been so stacked on other things as we were building new features, the whole thing was just piled on top. I can't wait to do a whole big postmortem because it's been, and both of you have seen how stressed I've been about doing everything all at once. That's been difficult. But this process, because it happened, once we started it, that was like, we cannot, no more features, we're done.
Right.
Like, we've all agreed on that. And so that makes it much easier on the team. When anyone on the team, including myself, wants to add something, we've decided already not to. So, like, that feels pretty good. So I'm in a much more comfortable place now.
Cool.
But also, it's been really nice to work with the QA people and just really appreciate their expertise and their capacity to, like, do these things in ways that when I was doing them on other projects took a lot longer.
Yeah.
Because it was just another thing I was doing.
Right.
Whereas this is their area.
Yeah.
Right. And that I really appreciate that a lot. So whether you're a developer who is lucky enough to have folks with this expertise to help your project, or whether you need to cobble together the experience or expertise to do it on your own, I think a lot of these things apply. Like, it's a thing that scales very well, I think.
Yeah.
These workflows. And thankfully, as much as all these tools that are available have issues, all of them will get the job done mm-hmm. at any size. Yeah. Even Jira can be used on a small team.
Uh-huh.
If, you know, if you've got the guts.
True.
I literally put on my LinkedIn as a in my description that I will always update my Jira board. It is still true.
That's, I mean, that'll get you a job.
Yeah, it will.
Because everyone hates Jira and no one treats it well. And so, which is, that's a burn on Jira, but also if you have the extra, put in the extra effort.
Yeah.
You know, that's yeah. a, that is a hireable.
Yeah, for real. For real. Lydia.
Hi.
You are going to a conference soon.
I am.
To the Serious Play conference, yes?
Yes.
Yes. And you were asking us what we could ask or what you should ask while you were there.
Yeah.
But we're not the people I think you should ask. You should ask people in Discord.
Yeah. Discord. Hello. It's Lydia. Are you going to this conference? Have you existed in Rochester, New York before and have recommendations for things I should do when I'm not at the conference? Do you have ideas of what you want to hear about from that episode besides what on earth the esports thing is about?
That's my question. That's my only question is, are you going to the esports thing? And can you tell me about it when you come back?
I will ask those questions. But I also want to hear your questions, Discord. So, at me or the other hosts, mm-hmm. Have a conversation in Nice Games Club.
Nicegames.club/Discord.
Nicegames.club/Discord. I'm not usually the one who does the Discord.
I got you.
Thank you.
Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
We're already running late, Steven. Tell us about your topic.
Oh, dear. Okay. So, hey, have y'all heard of this cool game called Blueprints?
We're going to talk about that game more?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Clearly, you finally got around to it.
I'm Mark behind
is
the curve.
Thrilled.
Okay. So, yeah, my topic is actually designing discovery because I can't figure out a way to make a whole 30-minute conversation about Blueprints and
not have Mark leave the room?
Well, that too.
Folks, he found a way.
I did. So one of the things that I've been really vibing with Blueprints is that like the puzzles trickle out really slowly. So I'm like discovering new things over time very slowly in a way that like other puzzle games, they tend to like dump a bunch of information at you a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, I have to focus on all of these things, and all of these things can be related to this whole massive puzzle, but also maybe just many tens of hundreds of small puzzles, and it can be really overwhelming.
And the virtue of giving you many things to do at once is if you get stuck on something, you can try something else.
Exactly.
Whereas Blueprints has all this other rigmarole you could do.
Well,
so it can give you one puzzle at a time.
Yes. So it works for me. Yeah. I mean, it's specifically designed for certain types of play.
Yeah.
In a way that like can be really frustrating when you want to just sit there and figure out a puzzle.
Yeah.
The massive one or the mini tiny ones. Blueprints gives you a bunch of mini tiny ones, but you can only have a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
And so it feels like I'm discovering new puzzles as I keep playing.
Yeah.
And that feels really good.
So there's always a thing to click.
Yeah.
Like even when you're kind of stuck or don't know what to do, you can just do something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I don't love that about it. I think it leads to problems, but like that keeps you engaged with the game.
Yeah.
In a way that with other puzzle games, you could just kind of like tilt your head and just stare for a really long time.
Yeah.
Because there's just literally nothing to click.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But like Blueprints just has lots of levers to pull and buttons to press. Mm-hmm. And they're all mistakes, but like you can do it.
I still like the game. Anyway.
This is what this topic's going to be. I'm just going to be jumping in with
I'm going to move away from Blueprints now.
Okay.
Don't worry, I'll steer him back.
Great. Okay. So, I want to talk about discovery as like from a design perspective, as a developer, because it's something that like I don't tend to like put a lot of effort into designing in that way. And I wanted to put some thought into it now while we have that opportunity. I do notice that I tend to get bored of games once I get to a point where like I've kind of discovered all of the gameplay that is available. And then it's just like get better at the game, unless it's a fighting game, which you don't exactly discover all of the game because you have to keep playing other people. And that's part of the discovery is that conversation between two players.
Well, another way of looking at that is that knowing, even if you don't know what all the moves are, even what all the mechanics are, you kind of get the gist of it so quickly that you kind of, you still have that early energy of starting a new game.
That's true. Yeah.
So you don't peg your satisfaction to that. Because it comes very early.
Yeah.
And so that kind of helps you then have a different checkpoint.
That's a good point. Yeah. That does a factor. I didn't really consider that.
Yeah. It gets deeper. It doesn't get
But
all the parts are there pretty early.
Yeah. That's exactly. So you figure out the quote unquote puzzle, and then the puzzle actually becomes figuring out how to beat this one specific opponent in a fighting game. Mm-hmm. In puzzle games, that's not the case. In roguelikes, that's not the case. It's like there's a bunch of stuff you can do. And eventually you get to the point where, like, well, with puzzle games, you solve it. With a roguelike, you get to the point where, like, you just have to keep getting better at the game because they have, like, different tiers or change up mechanics. Yeah.
You
and things
can
like
discover
that.
Different synergies, and that's often what's delightful, but, you know, that's not necessarily something you can plan ahead of time. That's more just, like, a serendipitous motive.
Yeah.
Or oh, man, what if I took this? Oh, that was a mistake!
Oh, yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. A traditional puzzle game will have, like, what if this works and then it doesn't? And
yeah.
Like, all right.
All right.
Whereas with a roguelike, that's so punishing when it doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, the outcome is very similar.
Yes.
In the sense that you either in puzzle games where you can stumble upon something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in roguelikes, I would say just the stakes are higher.
Yeah.
For that same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it might feel more pointed. It might be more disappointing and more satisfying.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. But like eventually you get to the point where like you just kind of discover all of the game, quote unquote. And then the rest of the game is just like, play more of it to get better.
Yeah.
Because you like this game or whatever. I that's when I kind of jump off of it. Mm-hmm. But like when you get to when you're just discovering things, that's like I think that's really exciting and fun.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about that some. I wanted to talk about like what kinds of things discovery can do for like a game's narrative or the design or even the gameplay feel.
Mm-hmm.
Do y'all have any thoughts on what that could, what kinds of things that does? I guess that's a really vague question.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I when I think of discovery, I always think of it in terms of narrative and love, and more like the level design and set dressing is where I find those. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it can be related to mechanics. So I guess narrative, like little side small moments. So for example, in Skyrim, I love there's a couple that gets that clearly has like saved up money to go elope. You find their stash of money, but before they got there, they got attacked and eaten. And if you leave, you come back, their corpses are removed and there's a statue to the goddess of love in place. So like clearly someone found them, saw the same diary entries and came to the same conclusion and made the place revered for them.
Aww.
Another one that I was thinking of is in Okami. At one point you have to make a mask for yourself. What I did with mine is I wrote the word for Japanese word for idiot on it, baka.
Mm-hmm.
And then much later in the game, there's graffiti on the wall in a city of what you draw on your mask.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious that like you're like, oh my gosh, I remember that. It's a very easy implementation, I imagine. Easy, quote unquote. I'm not a programmer. But like they just take the thing that you drew on the screen that you apply to mask thing, you apply to wall. But it was so delightful.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Yeah, it's like little bits, and I think of like open world games like Okami.
Yeah.
Those kinds of games tend to have like little bits of discovery in them.
Yeah.
That like when I'm playing them are like generally like nice satisfying bits.
Yeah.
Like all the in Breath of the Wild, the Korok seeds and stuff you could do. It's like, oh, I see this little rock and you know, this circle, it's missing a rock. Yeah. I put a rock there. Oh, yeah. That's fun.
I like
As long as you aren't tricked into trying to get them all.
Yeah.
It is fun to come across them.
Yeah.
I like connections between NPCs where it's like one talks about their son and then you meet their son later in a different town.
And you get
town.
More depth. And of course, that's a user story, right? Mm-hmm, it's like you're uncovering narrative through your play.
Yes.
Rather than it being like just doled out to you in a cutscene.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that a lot. Like I try to put a lot of that into Widget Satchel.
Yeah.
For like not expecting anyone to really care, but like there is a lot. Everything has motivation.
Mm-hmm.
But none of it is told to the player.
Yeah.
It is there to be sussed out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really appreciate that. And a lot of games do this. It's not that rare. But I do quite like when you can see the special attention where it's like, oh, this is... And then you come... Once you find a few of these things, you get a hint of that sort of level of depth.
Yeah.
Then you start to look at things, not as clues so much, but you start to trust that they're there for a reason.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, for a lot of games, it can be very demoralizing when, even for narrative light games... When like something is the way it is, and you just don't know why, and you're like,
is this just
because of some technical reason, or because
it's a video game,
cool or whatever,
yeah.
And it just sort of takes you out of it, and
yeah.
Even if you're not that focused on the narrative,
yeah.
It can be kind of dispiriting.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start to see like, oh, I didn't know what that was for, but then I found out that it was related to this thing, and then even with things that don't connect to anything else, you have this sort of trust that it's all there for a reason, even if the reason is like fictional within the world rather than deliberate by the developer.
100%.
It kind of just, it makes things more real.
Yeah.
And Lydia, like you were saying about the mask and the graffiti, like these are things that are not technical challenges.
Right.
Generally.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They're design challenges.
Yeah.
And the elegance of it can really, can elude developers who want to make complicated systems.
Yeah. I think a gameplay system, there's a lot of stuff you can discover in a gameplay system that can all mesh in a way that like can feel like discovery as well.
Yeah.
I oftentimes will think of like beat 'em ups and things like that. I mean, a lot of beat 'em ups have like parries and things like that, and you're like, why does this parry exist? But then like you play it more, and I think you like maybe will unlock something, or like you fight certain enemies, and like the way that you have to fight them, and the way that it like it starts unlocking and starts clicking in your head. Oh, this is why I have to do this thing. This is why this makes sense. I get it now. You know, it's that kind of stuff is really satisfying.
A pretty basic version of that, which is, that's not an insult, is Metroidvanias.
Yeah.
You can start to put, oh, I now have the double jump. I now have the dash.
Yep.
I now have this. And it's like, oh, with those things combined, I can now do this traversal.
Yeah.
In a way that like, you know, flummoxed me before.
Yeah.
And then that can be really, even when it was frustrating previously, that can be really satisfying.
Yeah.
Like, because the game isn't telling you to use it for this reason. You just, it gives you all the tools to figure it out.
Yeah.
Even if it's kind of obvious then, it still feels very,
like
a moment of discovery.
I felt that experience in Hollow Knight kind of, it was like, I was having not a great time with Hollow Knight until I got like the double jump or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it a dash? I can't remember. Because it's been a long time. And then it started, everything started to click and it felt a lot better.
Yeah.
And like, but like initially that beginning part was kind of a slog.
Yeah, it's a struggle with games like that to make it feel like you're not just waiting to unlock things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? I think the Metroid side-scrollers do a really good job of this, where there's a lot to do.
Yeah.
And you're like, what's that? Whatever. Like, you're not like, still like, oh, I need to unlock something for that.
Yeah.
Like, you do feel that a little bit in every Metroidvania, but like there should always be enough to do
right at
the level you're at.
And you're not discovering it if you already know that this thing is, you got to unlock something later, you know? Mm-hmm. If it's clear that you can't get to this thing and you can't quite figure out how to get it,
yeah,
that's more interesting than like, oh, I need to get a double jump, yeah, so I'll just come back here later.
We talked a little bit about that at Mark's topic a number of episodes ago, mm-hmm, about, you know, making sure that you're bringing the player in the direction you want,
yeah,
to discover what you want and not, yeah, be distracted by the discoveries over here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think there's also, you can discover something. In order to understand if it's important, you have to have context, because the inverse, I think, and something that I don't know why games did this, but ended up with a kind of deep-seated distrust, is like a lot of games would end up with gotchas.
Yeah.
So like you would get a thing and you would sell it because it's worth a lot. And then down the road, you'd find out, oh, it was this person's thing that you could have given to them to then do a stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, like, I really appreciate games that say, like, this is worth a lot of money, or you should try selling this at insert thing here. Like, Spiritfarer does that a lot.
Or this is a key item or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or it doesn't let you sell it. Yeah. I really appreciate that because they put in an important thing and did not give the context for why it was important thematically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As a, this is, and only gave it in context of, this is expensive, you could sell it.
Yeah.
And basically was like, gotcha, nerd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. I think there's a desire to, like, well, if you held on to it and then found out what it was for later, oh, wouldn't that be so satisfying?
Yeah,
yeah,
onto it.
This
but
is
there's no
why
you have to lead them, right?
Yeah.
And you could do it explicitly by saying, sorry, this is important, you can't sell it, but then the discovery is less.
Then you're like, no.
So you need that balance. So like a really good, you know, like Breath of the Wild does this pretty well, where like it gives you important items and it lets you squander them. But it does sort of hint that you might not want to.
Yeah.
And it's a delicate balance, and I think that's probably a matter of taste as well, whether you think it works or doesn't.
But I think the thing that it can be used for items, but especially is very well done in places, is I think what you mentioned is something, this looks important, or something's missing here.
Yeah.
I really like, one way to safeguard it is to have items that are incomplete, and specifically in the notes say, like, it looks like there should be a gem in this ring.
Because
then it tells you implicitly, I'm not done with this object.
Right.
Even if it is worth a lot of money.
Right.
So you are
a price giver.
Yeah, you're more likely to hold on to it at least a little bit longer to then have more information to determine, is this worth holding on to? Mm-hmm. With a location, I think that's more classic. You know, you see a rock missing, you see like, oh, the door is locked, I need a key, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But that way you are not, your sense of discovery is not burdened by the fear of missing out.
Yes.
If you don't keep everything.
Yeah.
This is why I don't let go of anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Those games have kind of trained you to do that.
Yeah.
It's maybe problematic.
So this the successful execution of that is very much tied to what it does in linear narratives. So a lot of people love watching movies and being really proud of being able to guess what comes next.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But like the movie is trying to tell you what's going to come.
Yeah, it gives you hints.
So like you can be pleased that you picked up on it, but you shouldn't necessarily feel like Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless it's a mystery that the movie doesn't want you to find out and you assessed it. I mean, whatever.
That's different, I guess.
Experience it how you like. But like, but a well-written story is, you know, surprising but inevitable, right?
Yes.
Like you are kind of meant to figure it out. Like that is the best stories are that. And that's maybe a matter of opinion. But games have that too.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're talking about is a version of that. But you are the one telling the story as well as the one being receiving the story.
Yes.
So it's definitely a harder task to do well.
Right.
Because you can, because if you don't give the player the agency to not tell that story, then they don't feel like they did.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Even when they mechanically did.
Yes.
So it's tricky.
It is really difficult. Yeah. And I mean, that's what I bump up against when it comes to, I'm bringing back Blueprints. That's what I bump up against with other puzzle games is oftentimes I'll get stuck by one puzzle and I'm like, I got to figure out this one puzzle. And I'm sitting there for an hour. I can't figure it out. And I get frustrated and I stop playing the game.
Yeah.
Blueprints, you could just move on to other stuff. Other puzzle games, lots of times they give you plenty of other puzzles to move on to.
Yeah.
Right.
And they might help you out.
Blueprints lets you just like do 100 jumping jacks and then you feel like you accomplished something.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. No.
From what little I have heard, though, I do like hearing kind of the nuggets of discovery about the people in the house from Ian.
Yeah. That is fun.
Ian has started doing the post-game stuff, and at one point he found something and audibly said, we had headphones on, I'm playing Dave the Diver, audibly said, man, this guy hates his job.
Yeah. A lot of times, environmental storytelling is when this is done best.
Yeah,
and Blueprints has a ton of that stuff.
It does.
Yeah, you got to keep an eye out. And if you weren't paying a lot of attention in your first like 20 hours, it's all still there for you to discover as you get frustrated with the rest of it.
Yeah, that's true.
So like if you haven't, you know, you'll eventually run out of all of that.
Yeah.
But like before you do, it is there's a ton of it, and it's really well done.
Or in a game that's shorter or more your cup of tea, if you replay it, you have that same experience of watching the movie and going, oh, wait a second. I recognize that hat.
Yeah, that's always really satisfying when you come back to something and then you discover why this thing existed.
Or the little subtle hints of why things were this way.
Yeah, that's great.
A sort of a marriage of the sort of environmental storytelling and mechanical elements is, I think Mario Odyssey does a really good job of this, where there are types of moons.
Yeah.
The game... Moons that you collect in the game are very much categorized.
Yeah.
Like some are like platforming challenges, some are like Easter egg hunts, some are like boss battles. Some you just buy. Yeah, exactly. There are essentially categories of moons.
Mm-hmm.
So what's really fun about that game is when you discover a new category of moon that you didn't really understand before, and then you think back, wait, there. Oh, I know where six more are.
Yeah.
That is so satisfying. Mm-hmm. And then you go and find them.
Yeah.
And you know they're there
because
you have that new piece of knowledge and you picked it up some random place likely. So it feels much more like a user story, like it was your narrative
rather than
the developers. And like, frankly, not every player is going to have that experience because it's every player goes through it differently.
Right.
You might find a lot of those categories early on, or you might stumble onto things and not pick up on it being a category.
Yeah.
You might think it's a one-off, or you might miscategorize it in your head or just be moving through it quickly. And the game lets you not have it. It doesn't force it on you. But I would suspect most players have had at least one moment like that when playing that game.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I feel like
I would guess.
I feel like I was more surprised by the specific moons than like the category of moon. Because I feel like when I got through, I feel like I kind of understood most of the categories of moons by the time I got a little ways into the game.
But like their take on that theme kind of.
Yeah, some of that. Or maybe like there's some one-off moons. My favorite moon is the one where you're sitting next to the guy who's depressed, and you just cheer up, and you make his day. It's great. Yeah. Then you get a moon from that, I guess, because players need to get rewarded, I guess. Yeah. But
well, some of the one-off ones keeps it a little bit ambiguous as to how many categories there are.
Yeah,
and like, is this a one-off or a category? And so it keeps things a little bit mysterious.
Yes,
so that the discovery can be a little bit funner.
I think.
And that's all very again. I think a lot of it is to taste, and depending on your experience going through. And I think a lot of it is definitely like the. It's a challenge for the developer to sort of balance all that stuff, right? And I think that game did a really good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, listeners, I would love to hear more about like games that you have played that you felt you've discovered really interesting things about, and maybe things, lessons we can learn from that as developers, what we can take into the games that we make as well.
I'd especially like to hear the discovery in terms of like systems mechanics, because again, like my sense of discovery and where I find delight is very narrative and story and space.
Yeah, but like things can click in all forms in video games because they're so big.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes, delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. They recently made a change in Jira, by the way, which lets you easily change a ticket to a bug or vice versa. Instead of having, because before you'd have to go into a thing and say move to, and then you would say it moved to from story to bug or from story to improvement.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And it was awful. But now you can just go like, boop. It's so nice.
Oh, yeah, that reminds me of one of the things I hate about Jira. It starts off by making you categorize a thing, whereas everything starts as a stem cell, right?
Yeah.
It should start as a generic thing and should get more specific.
Mm.
So that is an improvement. But that doesn't sell me on it at all.
Oh, no. Like, you still, like, I saw an ad for it, for Jira, on, like, a bus stop in Chicago during my honeymoon. And I went,
in this time of celebration, how dare.
Oh, so funny.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.